Welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program will feature articles from the Associated Press, from Religion News Service, from the New York Times, and more. This broadcast is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Begin this week's episode of Religion in the News with an article from the Associated Press dated August 18th. The title of this article, Israeli Court, Damascus Bibles to Stay in National Library. This article is by Ilan Ben-Zion of the Associated Press, Dateline Jerusalem. A quarter century after Israeli spies, a Canadian activist, and a Syrian rabbi smuggled 9 rare medieval Jewish manuscripts out of Damascus, an Israeli court decided the books will remain under the National Library's custodianship for their preservation. The decision ends a protracted legal battle over the ownership of the Damascus Crowns, illuminated Bibles written on parchment that belonged to the Syrian capital's Jewish community for centuries until they were secreted to Israel in the 1990s. The Jerusalem District Court ruled Monday the books were treasures of the Jewish people that had historic, religious, and national importance and must be preserved. The best way to do so would be to keep them at the National Library under a public trust, it ruled. The trust and its conditions are aimed at ensuring, first and foremost, the preservation of the Damascus Crowns and their care for the public, the Jewish people, and future generations, the court said. The manuscripts were originally composed in Europe in the 13th to 15th centuries before eventually migrating to Damascus. The Hebrew Bibles, unlike traditional Torah scrolls, contain vowels, punctuation, and other marks indicating correct pronunciation. The elaborately decorated Bibles were highly treasured by the Damascene Jewish community and only taken out on rare occasions. Most of Syria's Jews fled the country following Israel's creation in 1948. Those who remained suffered persecution and severely restricted freedom of movement that was only lifted in the 1990s. Only a handful remain after Syria's decade-long civil war. Israel's Mossad intelligence agency worked with Canadian activist Judy Feld Carr and Rabbi Abraham Hamra, the Damascus Jewish community's last leader, to sneak the crowns out of Syria and bring them to Israel. Many details of the operation remain undisclosed to the public. In an affidavit to the court, Feld Carr said that in 1993 she coordinated with Hamra to give one of the manuscripts to a Canadian diplomat who slipped it out of Syria in a black plastic shopping bag. The National Library, whose mission it is to collect and preserve Jewish heritage and cultural objects, has held the crowns since they arrived in Israel. Hamra has long contended that Israeli officials promised the books would be returned to him so they could be housed in a cultural center dedicated to Syrian Jewry. He said he was granted a plot of land in a Tel Aviv suburb for the center. Decades later, construction has not started. He sued the library for ownership of the crowns, and the library countersued in 2014 and asked the court to place them in a public trust under the institution's authority. "I came only to fight for justice and integrity," Hamra said ahead of the court's decision. The library's appeal to the court reflects its concerns about the legal grounds for holding on to Jewish cultural heritage items smuggled out of other countries. Although Syria has not made a claim for the collection, many Western countries now face pressure to repatriate cultural property stolen from their countries of origin, such as Iraq. On arrival in Israel, the manuscripts required restoration work to prevent further decay. They are kept in special climate-controlled conditions to preserve them, the library said in its arguments to the court. Aviad Stolman, former head of collections at the National Library, said it offers the most secure place for the Damascus Crowns. "Few institutions have the resources or expertise to preserve the ancient books," he said. "It's very expensive and very difficult for an independent institution to preserve such documents." The court determined the trustees will include members of the Syrian Jewish community in Israel, representatives from the National Library, the chief Sephardic rabbi of Israel, and the president of Hebrew University, and Rabbi Hamra. Meir Heller, the attorney representing the library, said the court's ruling was a coup for the preservation of cultural heritage in Israel. "We succeeded to save the books from a horrible place," Heller said, adding that they now found a proper home. We'll turn next to Religion News Service and an article from August 19th entitled, 2,500 of Evangelicals Sign Pandemic Statement Warning, Don't Ignore Science. This is by Yonat Shimron of Religion News Service. Amid some churches' ongoing defiance of state pandemic safety rules, a group of prominent evangelicals has signed on to a statement affirming their belief in science and calling on Christians to follow the advice of public health experts. A Christian statement on science for pandemic times expresses concern for the politicization of science in the public square when so many lives are at stake. Signers pledge to wear masks, get vaccinated, and correct misinformation and conspiracy theories. To date, the statement has been signed by 2,500 Christians. Among them are theologians N.T. Wright and Richard Mao, and the presidents of several seminaries, including Mark Laverton of Fuller Theological Seminary and Michael Leroy of Calvin University. Signers also include Samuel Rodriguez, president of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference, and Lisa Sharon Harper, a popular writer and activist. The statement was drafted by leaders of BioLogos, the nonprofit founded by Francis Collins, director of the National Institutes of Health, to bridge science and faith. Collins, a committed evangelical, was not involved in drafting the statement. We felt like the faith side was being stereotyped as all being on the anti-science side, and we wanted to show there are a large number of Christians in this country who are supportive of rigorous science and think the public health measures are important, said Deborah Harsma, president of BioLogos. First published on Monday, August 17th, the statement follows the widely reported case of a Los Angeles megachurch led by Pastor John MacArthur that has defied public health orders by meeting indoors without masks or social distancing. Grace Community Church filed a lawsuit last week challenging the coronavirus mandates. The statement appears to allude to such churches, saying, "Our faith calls us to sacrifice ourselves for others and accept temporary limitations on our freedoms because we have a permanent and complete freedom in Christ." It also explains the scientific method of testing, vetting, and arriving at consensus. And it sends a pointed message about heeding expert opinion. When Dr. Fauci, the nation's leading infectious disease expert, tells us what scientists have learned about this infectious disease, he should be listened to, the statement reads. BioLogos, which receives much of its support from the John Templeton Foundation, takes concrete steps to educate evangelicals about science in a way that makes room for their faith. It accepts evolution and human-caused climate change, often debated topics in evangelicalism. Our next article on Religion in the News this week comes from the New York Times, the August 20th edition, and this is entitled, In South Korea's New COVID-19 Outbreak, Religion and Politics Combine, or Collide, rather. The subheadline, The Sarangjil Church in Seoul has been a magnet for thousands of conservative Christians who fear their country is turning communist under President Moon Jae-in. Many have contracted the coronavirus, and this is by Cho Sang-hun of the New York Times, Dateline Seoul, South Korea. For months, the red brick church in a rundown neighborhood of Seoul, the South Korean capital, has attracted thousands of politically active conservative Christians, all united in the belief that their country is falling into a godless communist hell under the leadership of its liberal president, Moon Jae-in. Devotees of the church, known as the Sarangjil Church, whose name means love comes first, have participated in some of the largest anti-government protests the country has seen in years. If we hesitate, it will not be long before we live under the great leader of North Korea. Do you want that? The Reverend Jung Kwon-hoon, the church's chief pastor, said during a large anti-government rally in central Seoul last Saturday. Now their political crusade is colliding with the coronavirus as a large outbreak centered on the church spreads fast through Seoul and beyond, threatening the country's success in fighting the pandemic. Mr. Moon has accused his most vocal critics of spreading the infectious disease and putting the entire nation in danger, a sentiment widespread on social media. Police officers have been sent to track down Sarangjil congregants who have broken quarantine. But in today's polarized South Korean society, fraught with fake news, conspiracy theories, and fear-mongering, alternative narratives have also taken hold, purporting that the congregants have become the target of a political witch hunt or even a terrorist attack from communists. Conservative activists have accused Mr. Moon of trying to scapegoat the church to divert attention from his weak approval ratings, which have been plummeting over domestic policy blunders like soaring housing prices. Church officials even suspect health officials manipulated virus test results to keep Mr. Moon's diehard critics quarantined. In the past week, the outbreak has forced the church to shut down and its congregants to isolate themselves at home. The infections among church members and their contacts have spiked to 676 cases, including Mr. Jun. The outbreak pushed South Korea's daily caseload to 288 on Thursday, the seventh straight day of triple-digit jumps, which shattered hopes that the country had managed to blunt the epidemic sooner than most nations. It marked the biggest cluster of infections in South Korea since an outbreak in the Shincheonji Church of Jesus in the central city of Daegu in February and March was tied to 5,200 patients. Health officials have warned that the outbreak at Sarangjil could prove far more devastating than Shincheonji's. It has erupted at the center of the Seoul metropolitan area, home to half the country's 51 million people. Sarangjil's congregation is much older and could prove weaker to the virus than that of Shincheonji. Unlike Shincheonji's secretive congregation, many of Sarangjil's 4,000 congregants traveled from across the country to attend Mr. Jun's sermons and political rallies in Seoul. Health officials have been racing to track them down for testing and isolating, warning of massive nationwide transmission. The number of people coming to our church has ballooned in recent months, although not all of them are registered as our members, said Han Hwan-ho, 51, a worshiper at Sarangjil since 1987. On weekends, there were so many traveling from other cities that the church quickly filled up, and many had to sit outside in the alleys in plastic chairs. Mr. Han said people flocked to the church out of fear that our country is falling under communist influence and to defend our country's alliance with the United States and our freedom of religion. I am convinced that our pastor was speaking like a prophet when he said that our country was in danger of communization and that we would lose our religion when that happened, he added. South Korean politics have long been an ideological battleground. Liberals have championed reconciliation with North Korea and favored a balanced diplomacy between the United States, South Korea's most important military ally, and China, its biggest trading partner. Conservatives, especially older Christians, have loathed North Korea, feared China, and regarded anything less than unequivocal support for the alliance with Washington as communist. Conservatives lost power when South Korea impeached President Park Geun-hye, a right-wing icon, on corruption charges, replacing her with Mr. Moon, a liberal, in 2017. Mr. Moon's Democratic Party won a landslide in parliamentary elections in April, thanks to his government's successful fight against the coronavirus. Older conservatives deeply mistrust Mr. Moon, accusing him of putting South Korea under the influence of North Korea and China at the expense of its alliance with the Americans. But they feel voiceless, as the conservative political opposition remains unpopular and disarrayed in the aftermath of Ms. Park's impeachment. Ultra-right-wing Christian activists moved from the political margins to fill the vacuum. The star among them was Mr. Jun, the main architect of a faith-based conservative political activism in the country. At his political rallies, people waving South Korean and American flags have prayed to God to unseat Mr. Moon and condemn North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, to hell. They've shouted hallelujah and spoken in tongues. They believe that Christianity cannot share the same house with communism, said Hwang Kyung-gu, a popular YouTuber who leads a conservative activist group named the Korea Patriotism Patrol Team. They see their campaign against Moon Jae-in as an ideological conflict, a free world versus communism. South Korean Protestant churches have deep ties with the United States. American missionaries brought the religion to Korea. Many of the megachurches in South Korea were founded by Protestants who fled communist persecution in North Korea before the 1950-53 Korean War and benefited from post-war aid from American churches. To older Christian conservatives who remember the carnage of the war and the poverty that followed, religious faith remains synonymous with anti-communism and loyalty to the alliance with the United States, which defended South Korea during the war. Mr. Jun has roused these old sentiments with sermons replete with expletives against Mr. Moon. He calls Mr. Moon a chief North Korean spy and urges his followers to become martyrs in a war to drag him and other North Korea followers out of the presidential Blue House. He speaks in a language his audience can understand and likes to hear, said Hwang Gui-hog, the editor-in-chief of the Seoul-based Law Times, which specializes in church news. He scratches them where it itches the most. Health officials are now investigating the source of the virus in the Sarangjil congregation. The first case was reported on August 12. Amid a surge in infections, the government ordered congregants to stay home last week. But on Saturday, at least 10 church members, including Mr. Jun, attended the anti-Moon rally in Seoul, health officials said. Mr. Moon called their behavior an unpardonable act against the safety of the people, accusing them of impeding the government's efforts to fight the disease. Sarangjil officials said they had enforced preventive measures against COVID-19 during their church gatherings and were urging all members to cooperate with the government. A deep anti-government sentiment among church members could impede the health authorities' efforts. Thousands of police officers were mobilized to track down more than 500 church members who remained unreachable although they needed testing. This week, in the southern city of Pohang, a woman tested positive after attending Mr. Jun's church gatherings. Before officials could take her into quarantine, she had run away with her Bible after biting her husband, who tried to stop her. She was later detained by police officers wearing full-body protective gear. Another participant in the pastor's rally fled a government-run quarantine center and was hanging out in cafes in Seoul when the police nabbed him. Kim Kyung-jae, a conservative activist who helped organize the Saturday protest, said Mr. Moon's government was witch-hunting the church and ruling with quarantine dictatorship. Mr. Han and the Reverend Lee Yun-jae, an aide to Mr. Jun, said that many church members suspect the government manipulated the test results to keep them quarantined, and said that some avoided free government-provided tests and instead got themselves diagnosed in private clinics. Health officials called such fears groundless. Before he himself was hospitalized, Mr. Jun claimed that the outbreak at his church was the result of a terrorist attack with the virus from Wuhan, China. An invisible hand from the outside was involved, he later said in an interview with the Christian website. Broadly speaking, it could be an act perpetrated by North Korea. We'll head back to Religion News Service for this next article from August 18th. And the title of this article is, After Another Priest is Killed in El Salvador, Local Clergy Ask, Who Will Be Next? And this is by Claire Giangrave of Religion News Service, Dateline Vatican City. A Catholic priest was found dead near his car August 7th in El Salvador, the most recent in a pattern of clergy killings in the country over the past half century. Friends and parishioners of the slain priest called for justice and urged the Vatican to protect our priests. The Reverend Ricardo Antonio Cortez, age 44, was killed while driving on a road in the southeastern part of El Salvador in early August. He was found with gunshot wounds but still had all his personal belongings, leading local police to rule out a robbery, but the reasons behind his death remain unknown. News of his death hit me right at the heart, said the Reverend Rafael Sanchez, a Salvadoran parish priest at the Church of San Nicola di Bari in Rome and a good friend of Cortez. Sanchez said he was shocked by his friend's death, especially since Cortez never mentioned that he feared for his life or was in danger. Cortez is the third priest to be killed in El Salvador in less than 3 years. The Reverend Walter Osmir Vasquez Jimenez was found fatally shot in March 2018, and the Reverend Cecilio Perez was slain in May 2019. All three deaths are unsolved. Cortez was the rector at the major seminary of St. Oscar Arnulfo Romero in the Diocese of Zacatecoluca in El Salvador. His death occurred some 40 years after the martyrdom of Romero, after whom the seminary is named. In March 1980, Archbishop Romero of San Salvador was killed while saying Mass, one day after his appeal to stop the repression taking place in the politically fraught Latin American country. He became archbishop at a time when left and right-wing forces in El Salvador were leading the nation toward a civil war, and he used his platform to denounce the torture and killings perpetrated by the leading military and political powers in the country. He's a figure Pope Francis has often praised for his preferential treatment of the poor and a shared vision for the church as a field hospital. Less than a month after Francis's election as Pope, he authorized the canonization process for Romero, which had been stalled by Francis's predecessors who were concerned with the Archbishop's progressive legacy. Romero was given his halo in October 2018. While thousands crowded the square in San Salvador to celebrate the new saint, local bishops were notably absent. After Romero's death, the country spiraled into a bloody civil war in which Catholics willing to speak their progressive views were often silenced or killed. In the past 40 years, more than 24 members of the Catholic clergy have been killed in the country. Once again, our diocese is stained with the innocent blood of a good pastor dedicated to his sheep, said Bishop Elias Samuel Bolaños Avalar of Zacatecoluca in a Vizio statement last week, addressing the tragic death of Cortez. Cortez and Sanchez attended the same seminary in El Salvador, and they were members of the same diocese. Sanchez described his friend as a very friendly and joyful person who was passionate about philosophy, just as he was about playing soccer. Together, they studied the controversial figure of Romero in the 90s and how his legacy and life resulted in such split public opinion. We would discuss projects at the pastoral and missionary level, especially the formation of seminarians, Sanchez said. Our ideal, along with other priests, was to create a formation modeled after the priestly profile of Monsignor Romero. The major seminary of St. Oscar Arnulfo Romero, located in the eastern part of El Salvador, wished to bring forward the ideals inspired by the saint. For priests, Sanchez said, Romero is the model for a true pastor who understands God's message to the people and who brings the cry of the people to God. Sanchez and a group of priests and parishioners from El Salvador are taking matters into their own hands and trying to piece together what happened to their friend and pastor. He suspects there might be people or organizations wishing to intimidate the church. The current situation creates a climate of fear, and now people ask, who will be next, he said. Priests who preach certain rights and values in El Salvador are viewed as uncomfortable, Sanchez said, and there are still risks for clergy who speak up against injustice. He believes Cortez's work with seminarians and young people may have put his life at risk. Cortez spoke forcefully about the formation of priests, the figure of Romero, and the need for a Catholic Church that is truly prophetic, Sanchez said, while criticizing the silence of the local hierarchy. We sometimes feel there isn't a clear concern on the part of the bishops, and this worries us, he said, adding the need for a strong and united front on the part of the Catholic hierarchy and the Vatican to defend justice and the clergy. His biggest hope for El Salvador is the future generations of seminarians and priests. I think the death of these young priests may push other young people to offer their life to Christ, even if it means risking our lives, he said. We'll head back to the Associated Press now on this article from August 16th entitled Mormons Cool to Trump Are Finding New Influence in Arizona. And this is by Jonathan J. Cooper of the Associated Press, Dateline Mesa, Arizona. Yasser Sanchez has twice worked to defeat Joe Biden's bids for the vice presidency by building support for Republican candidates among his fellow members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It wasn't hard. Now the lifelong Republican finds himself in the surprising position of supporting Biden and repelled from his party, he says, by President Donald Trump. We're taught to be steady, to be basically the opposite of the way he's lived his life, Sanchez says. Sanchez's view isn't as unusual as the Trump campaign would like. While many conservative-leaning religious voters warmed to him long ago, Trump has struggled to win over Latter-day Saints. His penchant for foul language clashes with the church's culture, teaching modesty and self-restraint, and his isolationist foreign policy is anathema to a faith spreading rapidly around the world. It hasn't helped that Trump has made a show of feuding with Senator Mitt Romney, Republican of Utah, among the best-known members of the church. Once just a headache for the White House, Trump's relative weakness with Latter-day Saints is now a growing political liability. His standing has slumped in several pivotal states, including Arizona, where members of the faith make up 6% of the population. Many are clustered around Phoenix, areas where the Republicans have struggled to hold their ground in the Trump era. This past week, the Trump campaign launched its Latter-day Saints for Trump coalition, sending Vice President Mike Pence to Mesa, a suburb of Phoenix, for the kickoff. Pence, who often serves as Trump's emissary to religious conservatives, appealed to church members' opposition to abortion rights and long-standing concerns over religious liberty. Trump has stood for the religious freedom of every American of every faith every day of this administration, Pence told the group of about 200 people. Last month, the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., hosted a conference call with reporters to commemorate Pioneer Day, a church holiday celebrating the arrival of the first church settlers in Utah's Salt Lake Valley in 1847. Trump Jr. said he was in Utah at the time for a fishing trip. Still, signs of discontent were clear. More than 200 people identifying themselves as Republicans who belonged to the church published an open letter Wednesday declaring their opposition to Trump and calling him the antithesis of so much the Latter-day Saints community believes. To be sure, Latter-day Saints have traditionally voted Republican and are likely to remain part of the GOP coalition. Clustered in solidly Republican states, they've long been a major force in GOP primaries and local politics across the West, but they've not held much sway in national elections. Trump won Arizona in 2016 by 91,000 votes. There are about 436,000 Latter-day Saints in Arizona, according to church statistics. Many live in Phoenix's East Valley suburbs, popular with young families, including Gilbert, Chandler, and Mesa, which traces its modern history to a settlement founded by pioneers from the faith in the 1800s. In recent elections, political consultants have considered these areas a barometer of swing voters, including women and college-educated white voters who have recently shifted Democratic. In 2018, several neighborhoods east of Phoenix popular with church members voted both for Republican Governor Doug Ducey and Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema. From the time we're young, we're taught, as are all Christians, that we're supposed to love God and love our neighbor, said Kathy Varga, a 39-year-old speech therapist from Mesa. I don't see that happening right now. I just see the country becoming more divided. Varga reluctantly voted for Trump in 2016 because she was worried about Democrat Hillary Clinton putting liberal justices on the Supreme Court. Now Varga says he believes Trump is threatening government institutions and the Constitution. She plans to vote for Biden, even though she disagrees with many of his policies, because the most important thing right now is to unify the country. It's unclear precisely how common Varga's view is among her faith. In the 2018 midterm elections, about two-thirds of voters who are members of the church nationwide favored Republicans. But Latter-day Saints were less likely than other traditionally Republican religious groups to approve of the way Trump was doing his job. Among members of the faith, 67% voted for Republicans, and 56% said they approved of Trump's job performance. By comparison, 80% of white evangelical Christians nationwide voted for Republican candidates, and nearly as many said they approve of Trump, according to an analysis of 1,528 midterm voters who are members of the faith, based on data from VoteCast, a broad national survey conducted for the Associated Press by NORC at the University of Chicago. Even Latter-day Saints who turned out to hear Pence this past week acknowledged they were disappointed in Trump's infidelity or uncouth language, but they also viewed it as a tolerable consequence of electing a straight-talking man unafraid to ruffle feathers. Although Trump rarely speaks about his faith or attends church services, these supporters said they believed he was a defender of religious freedoms, which is of paramount importance to members of a faith that settled in what is now Utah to escape persecution. We're able to continue practicing our religion. That's how our country was founded, said Norma Hastings, a 71-year-old church member from Gilbert. She said she thinks Pence helps keep Trump on the right road. Jen Crandall, a 48-year-old pianist from Mesa, said she looks to other figures in the administration and the campaign for connection. I like how hardworking his kids are, his wife, Crandall said. He's a family guy. Biden's campaign is also targeting Latter-day Saints in Arizona and elsewhere. A Latter-day Saints for Joe group was formed more than a year ago. In a virtual town hall for church members on Saturday, campaign surrogates tied Biden's economic, health care, and immigration agendas to church teachings on self-reliance, family values, and refuge. The church does not back candidates or political parties. We've reached the end of our time for this week on Religion in the News. We hope you've enjoyed the program. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. And don't forget, Religion in the News is available as a podcast at ncreadingservice.org. We'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News.